It's Debatable.
Welcome to It's Debatable on Campus FM 103.7, where every week students from the Department of International Relations at the University of Malta discuss a hot topic from current affairs. I'm Hilary Bruffa, and I will be your host for the next half hour. Today our topic for debate deals with the role of social media in international relations. Present in the studios to help us answer this question are Martina Portelli and Mark Portelli. Our academic advisor is Dr. Carmen Samut, who lectures on the media and international relations at the University of Malta. We will also be featuring a special report on social media produced by The Economist. As the world witnesses one technological advancement after another, it's little wonder that international relations has widened its scope to encompass facets such as social media. This was seen to play a pivotal role in affairs ranging from the Obama election to the so-called Twitter revolution in Moldova, and even the recent Arab revolts. Today, Mark shall expose his opinion on social media as the main propeller of change, whilst Martina is present to air her views that it is less of a propeller and more of a tool. Before our students open the debate, I'd like to welcome Dr. Samut, who will speak to us on the expanding international role of social media.
In our discussion of the social media and their impact on international relations, I wish to argue that technological determinism is a very reductionist perspective. According to this belief, technology, in this case the social media, is deemed to be the key driver of history. In my view, the social media cannot be divorced from other political, economic, and cultural developments. In fact, when we look at history, information and communication technologies were born out of Cold War politics. In 1962, the Americans responded to the Soviet launch of Sputnik with ARPANET, the predecessor of the Internet. Initial research was mainly funded by states. However, the end of the Cold War, which coincided with rampant deregulation throughout the 1980s, opened the way for economic players to become protagonists. So we can argue that these technologies emerged from political and economic struggles, and yet they are also transforming the way in which international politics are played out. The convergence of new technologies such as the internet and mobile telephony with the old media like television, radio and newspapers is of particular interest to those in charge of political communication strategies and public diplomacy. We are living in the era of soft power, where states acknowledge the need to win the hearts and the minds of foreign publics. In public diplomacy, states communicate with these external publics. There are attempts to move towards a new public diplomacy, where the world audiences can interact with states. ICTs provide excellent means for this end, and they are not merely used by strong states, like the United States. An excellent public diplomacy exercise came from Georgia a few years ago, where Queen Rania embarked on Send Me Your Stereotypes campaign on YouTube. Similarly, Israeli strategists are also trying to use interactive means, such as Twitter, in an attempt to mend the tarnished image of their country. In spite of this, technological advancement increased pressures on international players, as they now need to offer faster responses to emerging issues. ICT may open opportunities for greater transparency and accountability, But some question whether they can lead to improved global security. Do politicians now have adequate time to make vital decisions, like going to war, on the basis of reliable intelligence and sound feedback from their respective diplomats? So these are questions which political leaders have to make. International relations depend on national processes, and even here we can see that the social media are having a great impact. The Obama campaign in the United States illustrated the wonderful campaigning possibilities offered by ICT for democratic processes. The presidential campaign successfully engaged and empowered previously disenfranchised masses. Many assume that the rise of Obama, with his promise of hope for world politics, was actually can be attributed to the social media. Obama's campaign confirmed the great mobilizing potential of the Internet, which had already been acknowledged by international social movements, especially the vociferous anti-globalization movement that organized through the Internet and had no headquarters and no formal structures. ICT and the social media widened the scope and the role of the global civil society and enabled greater networking and more room for influence in international institutions like the United Nations, where there are now over 20,000 NGOs which have a formal advisory role. Recently, the Internet provided an effective platform for the voice of global civil society during the Copenhagen Summit on Climate Change. Even individuals had unbounded possibilities to take part in the debates that took place then. And then, in the past months, in recent months, we have all been looking in awe at the democratizing potential of the social media in the cases of Tunisia and Egypt, which have been dubbed as the Twitter and Facebook revolutions. Before the uprisings in Tunisia and Egypt, in 2008, we have also experienced other uprisings in Moldova and Tehran, which also were dubbed as the Twitter or Facebook revolutions. These cases have shown that regimes can no longer suppress strong opposition movements who manage to harness the power of Facebook and Twitter. It is becoming increasingly difficult for regimes to keep arresting bloggers and cyberspace dissidents. Yet, some grassroots movements may sometimes threaten international security, as experienced in the case of Al-Qaeda and the subsequent war on terror. There is also widespread concern that the Internet can be a channel for the radicalization of diasporas and of second-generation immigrants in the West. The attacks in Madrid and London engendered fears that Al-Qaeda was using ICT to recruit cell groups. Moreover, there are concerns about the role of the Internet in spreading racial and ethnic hatred, and these grew after the incidents of the Danish cartoons and also after Geert Wilders disseminated his incendiary movie Fitna through YouTube. In spite of these challenges, it is widely acknowledged that the Internet also provides great opportunity for international dialogue and understanding. We need to add that ICTs and the social media reduce the political and economic insularity of small island states like ours. It has been suggested that Second Life may provide the virtual space for those small states that may not have the personnel and resources to open embassies and consular services in all parts of the world. Through Second Life, they can extend their services virtually. While ICT facilitates a global two-way flow, some people are still marginalized. There is still a glaring digital divide that excludes underdeveloped populations who are mainly based in rural and poor areas. Hence, the Internet has opened greater possibilities, but this has also widened some of the old international divides between the North and the South. Efforts are being made to include more and more people, for instance, with the development of the $100 laptop, and there are other initiatives to try to include more people and include more users of the social media from these areas. Malta has now become one of the countries which has identified the possibilities of ICTs through a commitment towards an ICT-led economy when and if the Smart City project materializes. Yet this objective depends on the current fate of the globalized economy.
Thank you, Dr. Samut. Now let's begin our debate. Martina, you claim to have a moderate view of the role of social media. What is it that makes you take such a stand?
Technological developments over the centuries have always in some way or another affected the political landscape at national and international levels, and I don't mean to negate this fact. Technological determinists may argue that a society's technology drives the development of its social structure and cultural values, but I believe that this is a rather reductionist point of view. Anyone relying naively on technology is likely to find themselves isolated. A recent article in The Guardian by Paul Hilder about this very topic ran with the tagline, "Change is made by human beings and not Silicon Valley." And this is basically what I believe, that the humans propel the change and not the social media.
Okay, thank you, Martina. Now, Mark, you're more of the belief that social media is an important driving factor of international events. Can you tell us a bit about this?
Yes, I do believe that the social media is an important driving factor in international events. It was important, for example, to the Arab revolutions of 2011. A Cairo protester during the Egypt revolt claimed we use Facebook to schedule protests, Twitter to coordinate, and YouTube to tell the world. This is debated, obviously, but I believe that it is true. The social media helps facilitate the protests. Facebook, for example, has 600 million active users. I do believe that Arabs use Facebook, so this helped the organizations of the protests. Twitter was used to help coordinate. The tweets were posted online and read by the whole world. Videos from cameras and mobiles were posted online on YouTube for the whole world to see what was happening.
Right, thank you, Mark. Let's look at the Obama election as a case study of this topic today. Martina, after Obama's election in 2008, the blogosphere was rife with claims that social media had won the election for the new president. Do you agree with this statement?
To claim that social media won the election for Obama would be ludicrous. In my humble opinion, Obama's proposals regarding the economy, his candidate choices, platform positions and other factors had much more of a direct impact than the videos, networks and other forms of media that the Obama campaign used.
Right, so do you believe that social media played no part?
Definitely not. Consider the Obama campaign's ability to motivate young people or their astonishing ability to raise donations through small individual contributions. Social media likely had an impact on these factors, which in turn had an impact on the broader campaign. The political environment alone, with an unpopular president and an economy in disarray, also had an impact, but neither of these was under Obama's control. I do concede, however, that, like it or not, the best policy in the world can be useless if it's not communicated effectively. One thing was clear, that Obama's campaign featured a tightly integrated, well-produced communications campaign from start to finish.
Well, that's true. Well, Mark, you seem to hold more stake in the influence played by social media in the campaign.
Yes, I do believe this. For example, John F. Kennedy was helped into the White House by increasing popularity of a new medium, television. The same can be said about Barack Obama, who was also greatly helped by a new medium, but rather than television, it was social media. In a span of shorter than 3 years, it has become the most sought-after activity on the web. People will always want to know what is going on in the world. Eric Wallman claims that, in the future, we will no longer look for the news, rather the news will find us. Colin Powell, who is a retired four-star general in the United States Army, endorsed Barack Obama on the 19th of October 2008. Minutes after his endorsement, the news were posted on the web. This election forced broadcasters such as the NBC and CBS to change the way election news were covered. This was because people are finding content on the web, on such sites as YouTube and Wikipedia. After Powell's endorsement on NBC's Meet the Press, NBC had the announcement ready to go on its sister property, MSNBC.com. Here one can see the importance of the social media and the role it plays. People do not only use one source, but a lot of media sources so that they can form an opinion. With this means of coverage of the social media, Obama managed to be elected. Around 65% of the American population voted in the 2008 election. A Democrat had not been able to win Indiana and Virginia since 1908. Obama managed to capture both. Of course, there were other factors included, but I believe that social media was the most important drive. Obama, in his bid to become a president of the US, assigned Scott Gutstein to take charge of the use of social networking and mobile media platforms. When he joined Obama's campaign in 2007, he managed to attract 6.5 million supporters on Facebook, 2 million on MySpace, and 1.7 million on Twitter. Obama managed to beat Hillary Clinton and then McCain in the presidential race. People on Facebook and MySpace were all posting about Obama, so I believe this helped him a lot in his bid for president.
I see. Thank you, Mark. And thank you, Martina. You've both raised some very interesting points. We'll have to stop here for a short break, but when we come back, we'll be airing a special report produced by The Economist. Welcome back to this episode of It's Debatable, a platform for discussion for the students at the University of Malta. Today we're discussing the role of social media on international affairs. Before returning to our debate, here is a special report produced by The Economist.
Business. Social media. Is Facebook really worth $50 billion? And will its new financing scheme fall foul of regulators?
In 2009, Rolling Stone described Goldman Sachs, an investment bank, as a great vampire squid that likes to stick its blood funnel into anything that can make it money. This week, the squid inked yet another high-profile deal. Together with Digital Sky Technologies, DST, a Russian group, Goldman invested a total of $500 million in Facebook, valuing the world's most popular social network at a whopping $50 billion. The bank is also planning to set up a fund it will manage that will pump up to $1.5 billion more from wealthy investors into the company. For Facebook, the deal provides a mountain of extra cash to invest in things such as new data centers and acquisitions. It gives it fuel for further growth without the hassle of listing its shares. For Goldman, the transaction represents an opportunity to stick its funnel into an internet firm that makes investors drool. As well as benefiting from any further appreciation in Facebook's value, the bank plans to suck up fees for managing the new fund, and it is no doubt hoping that by cozying up to Facebook's top brass, it is boosting its chances of leading an eventual initial public offering, IPO, of the company's stock. News of the deal has sparked vigorous debate. Facebook's implicit value has risen fivefold since mid-2009, but skeptics doubt that a firm whose business model is unproven is worth more than established media giants such as Time Warner. Since Facebook is not obliged to divulge financial information, it is hard to know for certain whether Goldman and DST, which already owned a sizable chunk of Facebook stock, are overpaying. But Facebook bulls argue that the network's sheer scale is proving irresistible to advertisers. Deborah Aho-Williamson of eMarketer, a research firm, notes that Facebook has even begun to attract notoriously conservative and deep-pocketed advertisers, such as Procter & Gamble. The company is also starting to look more and more like a natural monopoly. MySpace, which used to dominate the social networking arena, has come to look like my empty space. It is rumored to be about to make yet more cuts to its workforce. And networking upstarts such as Twitter, which has also seen its valuation soar to $3.7 billion, have revenues that are a mere fraction of Facebook's, which are said to have hit $2 billion last year. Still, at $50 billion, Facebook looks rather expensive. If its sales really are $2 billion a year, that implies that Goldman and DST are paying 25 times current revenues for their shares. That would be a breathtakingly steep multiple, even by the giddy standards of the startup world. Moreover, Facebook has nowhere near as robust an advertising model as, say, Google, whose search-related ads are served up to users when they are often on the point of making a purchase. Much of Facebook's revenue comes from low-end display advertising, and though it will benefit from marketers' growing interest in word-of-mouth promotion, the company will have to scrap for those dollars with traditional media brands, whose rich content makes them attractive venues for social media advertising too. In spite of this, investors are still falling over one another to get their hands on Facebook shares, and Goldman is keen to help them, so long as they agree to abide by certain rules. Clients considering signing up to its proposed Facebook fund are reportedly being asked to commit at least $2 million each to it and to hold on to any shares they receive until at least 2013. A different problem for Facebook and Goldman is that Goldman's planned fund could fall foul of the Securities and Exchange Commission, or SEC. On January 3rd, Second Market, a broker-dealer in private company shares, said it had been asked by the SEC for data about pooled investment funds formed to buy private company stock, precisely the kind of vehicle that Goldman has in mind for would-be Facebook investors. In recent months, several other financial institutions have formed similar special-purpose vehicles that invest in private company stock, piquing the SEC's interest. This has prompted predictions that regulators may end up treating such entities not as a single shareholder, but as a collection of individual investors. That would have important implications for the companies in which they invest. An SEC rule requires private firms with 500 or more shareholders of record in a given type of stock to publish quarterly accounts and audited financial statements. Faced with such obligations, most firms seek a public listing. This rule was one of the reasons that Google ultimately decided to go public in 2004. Having to go public now would be a nightmare for Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg, its founder and chief executive, who is said to be keen to put off an IPO for as long as possible. The firm reportedly had fewer than 500 shareholders at the end of last year, including employees and venture capitalists, so it is no doubt hoping to avoid having its arm twisted. Facebook and Goldman seem to have the letter of the law on their side. Joseph Grundfest, a professor at Stanford Law School and a former SEC commissioner, points out that the rule in question states very clearly that a fund such as the one Goldman has in mind should be treated as a single shareholder. If someone says Goldman is violating the law, then they obviously don't know the law, he says. Were regulators to interpret the rule in any other way, it would have far-reaching consequences for, say, the venture capital industry, in which funds with multiple investors routinely take stakes in private firms. However, some observers say that the SEC may be tempted to conclude that the new breed of special-purpose vehicles being created by the likes of Goldman have been set up specifically to get around the 500 shareholder rule. They have the potential to include a much wider range of investors than a typical venture fund and may attract heightened scrutiny. Regulators have a duty to protect investors and weigh the concerns of companies that wish to remain private. It is a delicate balancing act, but anyone who invests in a market this frothy must surely realize it is also risky. Meanwhile, Goldman and the other banks which hope to turn these vehicles into a big business should consider friending some good lawyers.
That was a special report produced by The Economist. Continuing our debate, our next case study is Moldova. On April 6, 2009, a peaceful protest began in Moldova in reaction to what some claimed were fraudulent parliamentary elections that led to the re-election of the incumbent Communist Party. Many journalists began asserting that they were organized using Twitter, with headlines even including Moldova's Twitter Revolution. Mark, in light of this, how central do you feel that Twitter was to the internal organizing efforts?
I believe it was very central. The main social media used was Twitter. Facebook and YouTube were also used. The protesters used Twitter to organize themselves. It was called by the media the Twitter Revolution. When it was announced what happened, Twitter and Facebook were used to let the demonstrators know what they were going to meet, and also to instill awareness about the protests and flash mobs. Technology played a huge part and was able to facilitate these protests. Youth from Moldova who were living abroad were able to follow these events on a live stream, which was based in the square. Twitter also helped the followers know what was going on in the demonstrations. Of course, the Moldovans being tired of the communist government was another major factor, but the posts on Twitter and Facebook, and also the videos on YouTube, helped facilitate what is going on, and social media also helped change people's opinions.
Thank you, Mark. Martina, do you have less belief in the real power of the messaging platform found in the ability of expatriates and others around the world to follow the events in real time? And also, how do you feel about Twitter being used to mobilize people outside Moldova and to raise awareness, so to speak?
First of all, I concede that social networking played a sizable role in the organization of protests, but when it comes to the extent to which the event was or was not a Twitter revolution, there are a number of factors that come into play. For instance, the number of Twitter users in Moldova. As foreignpolicy.com writer Evgeny Morozov, and as well as one of the initial organizers of the protest, Natalia Murari herself, have noted, Moldova had relatively few Twitter users at the time, a number estimated to be between 70 and 200, although this is quite hard to determine, given that many users may not have provided their actual location when registering. Secondly, the use of Twitter in this instance appears to have been limited to the mobilization of some local supporters and raising international awareness. Since Twitter was the buzz of the mainstream media in April 2009, the media were quick to hop on any story that involved the platform. At that time, Morozov noted, it really helped that even non-technology people in the US and much of Western Europe were currently head over heels in love with Twitter.
That's a valid point, but what can you say about the effectiveness of Twitter in coordinating the protests?
As I said earlier, it is true that the initial organisation of the flash mob protest was due to the social media. However, events turned from calm to more chaotic. Many Moldovans were breaking into government buildings and smashing windows, which obviously resulted in arrests, injuries and allegations of police violence. Natalia Morari concedes that they also underestimated the explosive anger among young people at the government's policies and electoral fraud. So the main criticism here is that Twitter was too decentralized a platform. When you have an angry and disorganized crowd, I believe that a more centralized platform is needed.
Let's move on now to the recent Arab revolts. There are claims that the Arab Spring was brought about by a Twitter or social media revolution. Do you believe this is false?
When it comes to the recent Arab revolts, the arguments here are very similar to those raised vis-à-vis Moldova's so-called Twitter revolution. Social media definitely helped spread news and garner international attention and support, but ultimately I agree with those that argue that the Arab Spring was not brought about by Twitter or social media, but rather it was spearheaded by the people on the ground calling for change. So the importance of social media here was that it connected real-life activists with those online. So here, once again, we're seeing social media used as a tool and catalyst that helps cement all those who already share the common view.
Now, Mark, on the other hand, I believe you share the opinion that Twitter was more of a propeller in this instance. Can you enlighten us on this?
Yes. Social media was used very well in the Arab revolts of 2010-2011, especially in Tunisia and Egypt. The same thing happened here, where the social media websites such as Facebook and Twitter were used to help the people there organize the revolutions. The social media helped certain class of protesters to organize protests, communicate grievances, and disseminate information. The social media also managed to bring the attention of the world on the Middle East, and this led to the Middle East being supported. I believe that social media manages to empower people in crisis, and it brings them together.
If you'll allow me to interrupt here, rather than believing that social media is increasingly becoming a determining factor, I believe that the role it fulfills is that of a tool. It was a tool in the way that the printing press was a tool during the time of Martin Luther, when he used to put up his list of demands on the church door for the Reformation. It was a tool in the way that Ayatollah Khomeini would record cassette tapes and send them to Paris in the run-up to the revolution in Iran in 1979. So the revolution in Iran would have happened, the reformation back in Germany would have happened, and the revolution in Egypt would have happened whether we had social media or not. But what social media did was that they connected people and helped amplify the courage. Because I believe that these revolutions that happened recently were more of revolutions of courage rather than a revolution of Twitter and Facebook. So social media can be used as a tool to amplify political change as well as to empower.
Okay, thank you. That was Martina Portelli. On behalf of the team behind It's Debatable, I would also like to thank today's other participant, Mark Portelli, and our academic advisor, Dr. Carmen Samoud. Our special report was brought to us today by The Economist. I do hope you enjoyed today's program. If you would like to have your say about one of the topics raised in It's Debatable, visit our website, www.mirsa.org.mt, and click on It's Debatable. I'm Hilary Briffa, and on behalf of the Department of International Relations and the Malta International Relations Student Association, I thank you for tuning in and hope you'll join us next week on Campus FM 103.7. Until then, keep updating.